This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Robert Schumann once called Beethoven's Fourth Symphony a slender Grecian maiden between two Nordic giants, contrasting it with the epic feats of the Third and Fifth Symphonies. It was this statement that led writers, critics, and musicians to begin thinking of Beethoven's odd-numbered symphonies as the big, serious musical statements, and the even-numbered ones as more lighthearted contrasts that he dashed off between bouts of genius. But it also does the Fourth a disservice. If this symphony had been written by one of Beethoven's contemporaries, say Clementi or Dussek, it would be viewed as a supreme achievement of orchestral writing, towering above anything else they had written. Instead, thanks in part to Schumann, most of the focus has been on what it isn't, rather than on what it is. Hector Berlioz, who was right about a lot more things than his contemporaries gave him credit for, recognized Beethoven's Fourth as a return to an earlier sound world. Here, he wrote, Beethoven entirely abandons ode and elegy in order to return to the less elevated and less somber, but not less difficult, style of the Second Symphony. The general character of this score is either lively, alert, and gay, or of a celestial sweetness. End quote. In effect, Beethoven's Fourth is another one of his tributes to his one-time teacher, Franz Joseph Haydn, whom he always admired, even though they never quite saw eye to eye. Beethoven wrote his Fourth Symphony in 1806, while he was going through a period of financial difficulties, trying to cover not only his own expenses, but debts piled up by his relatives. Beethoven's normal summer routine was to rent a small house outside Vienna, but he decided to save what little money he could by joining his friend and patron, Prince Lichnowsky, on a trip to the province of Silesia. During the journey, he and the prince paid a visit to a Count Franz von Oppersdorf, who had his own private orchestra. Oppersdorf was so enthusiastic about music that he required everyone on his staff to play an instrument, and he was delighted to entertain Lichnowsky and Beethoven by having his musicians perform the composer's Second Symphony. Musicological opinion used to hold that the Count offered to commission a symphony, and Beethoven jumped at the chance. Now, there's no confirmation of this, and it seems more likely that Beethoven had already completed his Fourth, and that Oppersdorf offered to purchase the rights to it. However it came about, the Fourth Symphony seems to have come fairly easily to Beethoven. There are only a few preliminary sketches in existence, and they give no evidence of the agonizing experimentation and reworking that often show up in Beethoven's drafts. Beethoven was clearly on a compositional roll that year. Despite his monetary issues and his increasing deafness, he had already written his three Razumovsky string quartets, his Fourth Piano Concerto, the powerful Variations for Piano in C Minor, and his Violin Concerto, and was finishing up his Fifth Symphony and a revised version of the opera that would eventually become Fidelio. The first reference to Haydn in the symphony is in the introduction. It is quiet and introspective, constantly shifting harmonies, but always returning to a serious minor mode. It takes its time on its mysterious journey, and not everyone was amused. Carl Maria von Weber, who later said that Beethoven's Seventh Symphony was evidence that its composer was insane, condemned the introduction of the Fourth for not possessing enough notes to fill up the space it occupied. Every quarter of an hour, he complained sarcastically, we hear three or four notes. It is exciting. Well, hearing the piece for the first time, you might expect that a work of tension, suspense, and mystery lay in store. But then... Then comes the transition into the start of the movement proper, and it's clear that this will be one of Beethoven's most lighthearted symphonies. The movement unrolls according to the rules of a classical symphony, with a proper second subject being introduced through a perky conversation among the bassoon, oboe, and flute. But we can always rely on Beethoven to inject some unusual touches. The development section introduces a beautiful song-like melody weaving above, below, and around the return of the movement's main theme. What's more, the whole section spends a fair amount of time pretending that it's going to resolve to B natural, so near to, but yet so far from, the true home key of B flat. Eventually, it does find its way home, and a sudden hush builds up to the rowdy beginning of the movement's recapitulation. It ends in the same high spirits with which it began. The second movement is another tribute to Haydn, specifically his Symphony No. 101, The Clock. A recurrent rhythmic pattern both supports and contrasts with the tender melody unrolling above it. This movement is a sort of rondo, like a popular song. Verse, chorus, verse, chorus, though each time the chorus or refrain returns, it comes with considerable elaboration. At the middle of the movement stands an episode that the distinguished musical analyst Donald Francis Tovey called one of the most imaginative passages anywhere in Beethoven. It moves from an angry minor key transformation of the original theme to a delicate duet for violins. And the slow movement concludes with a coda in which the main theme is broken up and distributed throughout the orchestra. At the end, it's the timpani that pick up the rhythmic underpinning of the opening, which in retrospect sounds as if it could have been a drumbeat all along. In the history of the symphony, one of Beethoven's innovations was another of his departures from Haydn, replacing the third movement minuet with a scherzo, which in Italian means joke. Beethoven took full advantage of the possibilities, and in the fourth symphony, he has left the spirit of the classical minuet in the dust. Like the minuet, the scherzo has a contrasting middle section, called the trio. Another of Beethoven's innovations here is that he returns to the trio a second time, which gives him another chance to play off the cross rhythms of the main section with a lilting folk song. Beethoven apparently liked the balance he got by using this pattern, since he used it again in his 6th and 7th symphonies. The finale opens in perpetual motion mode and never lets up. Before he reaches the end, Beethoven works in a last laugh or two. Beethoven's audience would have had certain expectations about the course the movement would take. They would also have had expectations about how Beethoven would surprise them. The development section of the finale keeps the audience on the edge of their seats, wondering just where everything is heading. Where it's heading is just where the movement's main theme is expected to return for its concluding argument. But when it gets there, the theme is stated not by the full orchestra, but by a single bassoon, chortling through the flurry of rapid-fire short notes. The orchestra swoops in to pick up the tune and nearly makes it to the end before threatening to break down in exhaustion. A few instruments manage to puff out the theme, pianissimo, and half its tempo, and then, with a final surge of energy, Beethoven's fourth crosses the finish line. Beethoven's fourth symphony had its premiere in March of 1807, in a concert that also included the premieres of his Coriolan Overture and Piano Concerto No. 4. 1806 may have been one of his most difficult years, but it produced one of his happiest symphonies. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.